So I'm going to speak about three ghosts. Well, actually, now that I think about it, now there's probably more than three. Maybe Derrida is one of the ghosts. Actually, there may be lots of ghosts. So I'll say this. I'm going to talk about untimely visitations that I hope will speak to us about latency and the possible, the latencies of the possible, and the issue of ontology from the historical point of view. That is, the ways the past haunts us in the present and presses on the future, though then again, when you conjure spirits, one never is quite sure what they're going to say to you. So I'm going to begin with a tale from old New England, close to my home in Connecticut. This is Washington Irving's The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, although I should ask how many people, does anyone know this story, The Legend of Sleepy Hollow? So one, oh, lots of people know it. It's an interesting and charming tale. So in German, what would it be? Something like Die Legende der Schläfrigen Hollow or Hola, yeah, something like that. Ugh, pretty bad. So The Legend of Sleepy Hollow is a sort of strange tale about a figure, a school teacher from Connecticut who moves to Sleepy Hollow, and Sleepy Hollow is actually in upstate New York on the Hudson River, takes place just after the American Revolution. And this school teacher moves into this town, and when he gets there, he finds that all sorts of strange things happen to him. Now, they aren't actually strange things, because he's a guy who sort of has an interest in the supernatural. But as he moves in and inhabits Sleepy Hollow, he starts to sort of imbibe the various stories of ghosts and specters. And the main ghost, and we'll talk about this, is a headless horseman. But the story is really about his courtship of a young lady who's the heiress to a farm, his rivalry with another young man who's something of a ruffian, and it all comes to a head, if you will, at a party one night when Ichabod Crane goes to declare his love to this young woman. The other man's there, she rejects him, and riding home from this party that night, he hears something behind him, and he becomes increasingly afraid as he hears horse hoofs behind him. So he gets his horse moving, the horse behind him moves faster, he moves his faster. He recalls that in this legend about this headless horseman, if you can make it to a bridge past a churchyard, past a sort of haunted tree, you'll be safe. And he rides as fast as he can. But just as he's about to get to the bridge, he of course, in a kind of biblical fashion, looks back behind him. And as he does, the headless horseman hurls an object at him, his head. It strikes Ichabod Crane, who falls down and is never heard from again. That's the legend of Sleepy Hollow. Well, in some ways, it's a very simple story when you actually read it about a simple school teacher, this fellow Ichabod Crane. Here, let's see if we can find him. Well, here's the legend of Sleepy Hollow. And there's Ichabod Crane riding along. Now, it's true that he has some unusual attributes. Despite his quite meager, skinny frame, he had a prodigious appetite for food. They say he has the swallowing powers of an anaconda. And despite his learned calling, he had an equally prodigious appetite for tales of the supernatural, as evidenced by his well-worn copy of a book called Cotton Mather's History of New England Witchcraft. But all in all, this legend seems to be, well, less than legendary. The schoolmaster Ichabod Crane wants to marry the comely heiress, Katrina Van Tassel, for all the obvious reasons. She's a beauty, her father's a substantial farmer, and the farm itself is a veritable paradise of fecundity. But Ichabod's amorous overtures draw the ire of Katrina's other suitor, whose name is Brom Van Brunt, but, and here I quote, from his Herculean frame and great powers of limb had received the name Brom Bones. And of course you have the very meager Ichabod and the very big Brom Bones. Now Brom is a legendary horseman and a notorious prankster. So in retaliation for Ichabod's courtship of Katrina, he breaks into Ichabod's schoolhouse and, quote, turned everything topsy-turvy, so that the poor schoolmaster began to think that all the witches in the county held their meetings there in his schoolhouse, end quote. In short, Irving provides us with all the clues to deduce that Brom Bones is, in fact, this headless horseman, and that there is nothing supernatural or ghostly about this legend at all. Brom has a motive, and there is ample evidence of his past tricks. Thus, it comes as something of a surprise when, at the end of the story, after Ichabod Crane is chased down by the headless horseman while despondently riding home, having been dismissed by Katrina at the party, our narrator, a certain Diedrich Knickerbocker, refuses to draw this conclusion. Now, this is even after offering the testimony of, quote, an old farmer who had been down to New York on a visit several years after, and from whom this account of the ghostly adventure was received, brought home the intelligence that Ichabod Crane was still alive, end quote. So this is to say, the very person who recounted the legend to our narrator also dismisses it as false. So where does all the ambiguity at the end of the tale come from? Don't we simply know that Brom Bones is the headless horseman? And if so, is there any legend of Sleepy Hollow at all? This is all to ask, what haunts Sleepy Hollow? Now, our narrator described Ichabod as, quote, an odd mixture of small shrewdness and simple credulity, whose appetite for the marvelous and powers of digesting it were equally extraordinary, and both had been increased by his residence in this spellbound region, until no tale was too gross or monstrous for his capacious swallow, end quote. Indeed, we are told at the beginning that a, quote, drowsy, dreamy influence seems to hang over the land and to pervade the very atmosphere. Some say it was bewitched by a high German doctor during the early days of settlement. Others, that an Indian chief, the prophet or wizard of his tribe, held his powwows there before the country was discovered. Certain it is, the place still continues under the sway of some witching power that holds a spell over the good people. The whole neighborhood abounds with local tales, haunted spots, and twilight superstitions. But as we know, the dominant spirit that haunts this enchanted region is the apparition of a figure on horseback without a head. It is said to be the ghost of a Hessian trooper whose head had been carried away by a cannonball in some nameless battle during the Revolutionary War, end quote. So, what haunts Sleepy Hollow? On my reading, it is history. The history of Indian dispossession, of the Revolutionary War, of the unspoken atrocity that took place at what was called Major Andre's Tree, and countless other events, great and small. Sleepy Hollow is laden with the ghosts of a history half-remembered, if it is remembered at all. This is the latent past beneath the ghosts that haunt the inhabitants. What's more, and we are told quite remarkably, this haunting is, quote, not confined to the native inhabitants of the valley, but is unconsciously imbibed by everyone who resides there for a time, end quote. This is a past that we cannot touch, but that nonetheless touches us. The histories, the tales, the haunted spots are all partial reconfigurations, like a headless horseman. Now, the past, like a ghost, is by definition absent, and thus has no ontological properties per se, or, perhaps more accurately, it has a latent ontology. History is the presence of absence, and what we do have of it is that which presents itself to us, or we force upon it. But like the head of the long-departed Hessian, crucial aspects of the past are missing. They lie hidden, buried, forgotten, or lost. Latent possibles that could at any moment break loose and come hurling at us, seemingly out of nowhere, like the horseman's head did, striking Ichabod Crane. And to push this further, I want to note that Ichabod's future is decidedly altered by this visitor from the past, whether it sends him to New York or to join the other spooks and specters that haunt Sleepy Hollow. Either way, Ichabod, too, becomes a source of legend, for with his departure, quote, the schoolhouse soon fell to decay and was reported to be haunted by the ghost of the unfortunate pedagogue. But if we are to consider the past as akin to the ghost, and history as a hauntological endeavor, or as holding a latent ontology for those of you who are squeamish, then it is worth asking what it is that troubles us about the ghost. In Spectres of Marx, and here we revisit it again, Derrida asks the question, quote, what is the ghost? What is the effectivity or the presence of the specter? That is, of what seems to remain as ineffective, virtual, insubstantial as a simulacrum, end quote. The ghost or the specter is troubling precisely because it is the past come again, but emptied of its physical properties and disobedient to the rules of time and space. Quote, one cannot control its comings and goings because it begins by coming back, end quote. As does the ghost of Hamlet. Looks it not like the king? Asks Bernardo, to which Horatio replies, most like it. It harrows me with fear and wonder. But as Charles Dickens notes in his opening to A Christmas Carol, so what would that be? Eine Weihnachtsgeschichte, something like that? Is that right? That might be right. Quote, if we were not perfectly convinced that Hamlet's father died before the play began, there would be nothing more remarkable in his taking a stroll at night in an easterly wind upon his own ramparts than there would be in any other middle-aged gentleman rashly turning out after dark in a breezy spot, say, St. Paul's Churchyard, for instance, literally to astonish his son's weak mind, end quote. What is troubling and powerful about the ghost of Hamlet's father is not that it is present, which it is, but the ways that its presence disturbs all the spatio-temporal categories by which we have come to make sense of the world around us. The ghost troubles both time and space, and thus one cannot make sense of it. We cannot actually say what the ghost means. Like the past, it has no ontological properties, but nonetheless, it is. Indeed, if one could define it, if Hamlet's father was actually there, quote, there would be nothing more remarkable in his taking a stroll at night in an easterly wind upon his own ramparts than there would be in any other middle-aged gentleman rashly turning out after dark in a breezy spot, end quotes. In other words, if time were not out of joint, there would be nothing dramatic, remarkable, legendary, or eventful, to use Zepp's term. Indeed, Derrida might characterize the inhabitants of Sleepy Hollow as, quote, attempting to ontologize remains, to make them present in the first place by identifying the bodily remains and by localizing the dead, end quote. This in an attempt to tame the haunting past. This is, in any event, what I think most conventional historians do, ontologize remains to make them present through the approach I will refer to as ontological realism. Now, what I mean by ontological realism is a commitment to history as an endeavor concerned with events assigned to a specific location in space and time that are in principle observable and as such are regarded as fixed and immutable. No ghosts here, no dead fathers on the ramparts, no headless horsemen, no hauntology or latent ontology, just the facts, all of them. Everything possible, no latency left. Conventional historians in this sense are ontological realists in their research, writing, and teaching, even if they also claim to be epistemic skeptics, epistemic relativists, or even if they feel there's a great deal of hermeneutic entanglement between the historian and the past. But as the philosopher Louis Mink observed in On the Writing and Rewriting of History from 1972, such a belief, quote, in the actuality and immutability of the past is based on a cluster of unconscious and invalid analogies, end quote. For Mink, these included such analogies as between temporal distance and spatial distance, between memory and perception, or between a past present and a present past. To these, I would add the faulty analogy between the formal narrative presentation of a past as it happened and the ontological reality of that past. According to Mink, the ability to hold these analogies is indicative of the incompatible views we hold about the reality of the past, about the relation of historical knowledge to its object, whatever that be, and about the relevance of historical knowledge to the possibilities of action which lie before us. Mink sums up this paradox by articulating the way historians hold the simultaneous views that, quote, everything which belonged to the action when it was taking place in its own present belongs to it now that it is past, alongside the conflicting realization, quote, that the past isn't there at all, end quote. Mink sees this paradox as the motivating force behind all serious philosophy of history. I see it as proximate to what I refer to as the latent ontology of a past that is and isn't. And one of the most salient values of a deconstructive approach to this history is that it draws attention to the ways historians often maintain the teleological power of a principle whose possibility they refuse. But it bears asking as to the motivation that allows one to hold such incompatible views. In History and Fiction as Modes of Comprehension, Mink reflects on why some stories bear repeating. We could think of this in terms of Sleepy Hollow, but I think his response to this question will help us gain purchase on this previous question. Mink tells us that some stories bear repeating, quote, because they aim at producing and strengthening the act of understanding in which actions and events, although represented as occurring in the order of time, can be surveyed, as it were, in a single glance as bound together in an order of significance. A representation of the totem simul that Boethius regarded as God's knowledge of the world, which we can never more than partially achieve, end quote. Latency is removed from the equation, as is the surprise of the unexpected possible. One can, of course, imagine or read a story, a history, as if one did not know the outcome. One might not know the outcome, and thus one follows the story from beginning to end. But in the, quote, configurational comprehension of a story which one has followed, the end is connected with the promise of the beginning, as well as the beginning with the promise of the end. And the necessity of the backwards reference cancels out, so to speak, the contingency of the forward references, end quote. The indeterminacy of the future is canceled out by the givenness of the past that is grasped in the present. Here, quote, to comprehend temporal succession means to think of it in both directions at once, and then time is no longer the river which bears us along, but the river in an aerial view, upstream and downstream in a single survey, end quote. This aerial view can be considered as a God's eye view, or that of Laplace's omniscient scientist in his philosophical essays on probabilities. Each of these points to the issue of temporality and the desire for a static snapshot that arrests the temporal flow. On such a reading, and by and large this is the conventional historian's reading, time is never out of joint, and assuming one has the right methodological tools, one can master the past and recount it in the form of a realist narrative. If I may modify a passage from Derrida's Freud in the Scene of Writing, this ontological realist position is dangerous, quote, not because it refers to writing, but because it presupposes that the past exists as a text, which would be already there, immobile. The serene presence of a statue, of a written stone or archive whose significant content might be harmlessly transported into the milieu of a different language, and I would add, or time, end quote. The danger lies in the assumption that there is an unerasable and indelible trace left in the past by which the ontological reality of the past can be determined. But, quote, an unerasable trace is not a trace. It is a full presence, an immobile and incorruptible substance, a son of God, a sign of parousia, and not a seed, that is, a mortal germ. Good plant reference there, end quote. The stability afforded to identity is not the property of a mortal being who exists in and through the indeterminacy of time. Such a fixed, immutable quality belongs to a god or to the dead, and here I think we gain purchase on the force and seduction of ontological realism. The fiction of a stable past is the fiction of a stable present. Indeed, I would say that it is the meaning we don't or can't find in the present that ontological realists construct in the past. It makes sense going backwards, after the fact. But such a narrative cannot account for the latent ontology of the past or the ways that past possibles condition our possible pasts. What I mean by this is that our knowledge of the past is conditioned by what presents itself to us, both in terms of its remains and in terms of our reception. The limits of what we are willing to accept as past possibles conditions what we are willing to accept as possible pasts. That which lies beyond this realm appears to us as simply impossible, like a ghost. But the ghost is only impossible insofar as it is a remainder of a different time and place, and its untimely presence disturbs us. The latent past is not the impossible. It was possible, and it did happen, though perhaps it has been rendered inconceivable or unimaginable, and thus exiled beyond the realm of what now appears as possible. It is when what lies latent appears, returns, that history haunts us, and we are confronted with the possibility that our understanding of the past is only partial. This partial past is one possible past, to be sure, but one that does not account or budget for a host of past possibles that have been suppressed, effaced, lost, or forgotten. And these are the ghosts and specters that haunt us in the present. The history of Sleepy Hollow is not only that of charming rustic settlers prone to tales of the supernatural, but also, and importantly, a history of violent dispossession, the violent dispossession of Native Americans from their land, among other various acts that we don't seem to see or hold. When what is latent of the past becomes manifest, it opens new historical possibilities. Of course, these remnants of the past are only new in the sense that they can now appear within the realm of the possible, as a possible past, thus altering history itself. This is all to say there is no past to be recovered in the form of the realist narrative or as a determinate object of history, because that is not the structure of the past. This is neither the ontology nor the reality of the past, and thus I think there is light to be gleaned in thinking of the past itself as sort of blinking in and out of our existence like a Christmas light. This certainly gives me occasion for a visit from the ghost of Christmas past in Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. Now, Dickens describes the ghost of Christmas past as, quote, a strange figure, like a child, yet not so like a child as an old man, viewed through some supernatural medium, which gave him the appearance of having receded from view and being diminished to a child's proportions. Its hair was white with age, and yet the face had not a wrinkle in it, and the tenderest bloom was on the skin, end quote. Here one can imagine this spirit as the object of history, an aged object from the past, transported to the present by the historical author, who imbues it with youth and the tenderest bloom of the skin, even while signaling its age, the whiteness of its hair. It is in this way that the historian presents the old man of the past event as a child, as though through some supernatural medium. Quote, but the strangest thing about the ghost was that from the crown of its head there sprung a bright, clear jet of light, though it also possessed a great extinguisher for a cap. Even this, though, was not its strangest quality. For as its belt sparkled and glittered, now in one part, now in another, and what was light one instant, at another time was dark, so the figure itself fluctuated in its distinctness, being now a thing with one arm, now with one leg, now with 20 legs, now a pair of legs without a head, now a head without a body, of which dissolving parts no outline would be visible in the dense gloom wherein they melted away. And in this very wonder, the very wonder of this, it would be itself again, distinct and clear as ever, end quote. The past here is no fixed and immutable object, but a fluctuating bundle of physical and temporal contradictions, young and old, near and far, light and dark, a figure that is at one moment indecipherable and the next distinct and clear as ever. Its strangest quality is never strange enough, and here one must wonder what, if anything, is gained by the tautological assertion, quote, it would be itself again, that prefaces the statement distinct and clear as ever, the ontological realist's dream. But I want to go back to the quality of the ghost that is and is not the strangest thing about it. And this is the bright, clear jet of light that sprung from the ghost's head, though I also note the great extinguisher for a cap, which it now held under its arm. The strangeness of the light evokes images of Freud's category of the uncanny, Unheimlich, as, quote, the name of everything that ought to have remained hidden and secret and has become visible, end quote. The past is there, all of it, every possibility lying latent, though vying to burst forth. Upon encountering the ghost, Scrooge had a special desire to, quote, see the spirit in his cap and begged him to be covered, that is, to keep hidden and secret that which ought to remain so, but the ghost simply would not comply. Nevertheless, after a long evening of strange encounters, Scrooge could no longer bear to be haunted by the past and began to wrestle with it. Here I quote, in the struggle, if that can be called a struggle, in which the ghost, with no visible resistance on its own part, was undisturbed by any effort of its adversary, Scrooge observed that its light was burning high and bright, and dimly connected that with its influence over him. He seized the extinguisher cap and by a sudden action pressed it down upon his head. On my reading, ontological realism bears an uncanny resemblance to the extinguisher cap and the historian who wields it to Scrooge. For like Scrooge, the historian who wrestles with the past does so with an adversary that offers no visible resistance on its own part and is undisturbed by any effort on the part of the historian. The disturbed remains haunt us and not vice versa. But more important is Scrooge's sudden action in response to his observation that the light of the past exerted influence over him. The conjuring trick of ontological realism is that it allows the historian to exert his or her influence over the past by restricting its light and all that its light reveals, pressing down and concealing the past possibles that expose other possible pasts, in the same way that Scrooge pressed the extinguisher cap down upon the ghost of Christmas past. Quote, but though Scrooge pressed it down with all his force, he could not hide the light, which streamed from under it in an unbroken flood upon the ground, end quote. You cannot kill a ghost, and history continues to haunt. So what are historians to do with such an unruly visitor as the past? With a ghost that offers no visible resistance on its own part and is undisturbed by any effort of its adversary, and yet is all the more resistant and at times adversarial all the same. Like the ghost, history is a revenant brought to the present by the historian. It visits us, but does not belong to our time or place. Derrida links the ghost to the trace and to différence, thus challenging notions of absolute priority or absolute foundations. Quote, and this is Derrida, one can expose only that which at a certain moment can become present, manifest, that which can be shown, presented as something present, a being present in its truth. Now, if difference is, and I cross out the is, what makes possible the presentation of the being present, it is never presented as such, end quote. Without remaining beholden to Derrida, but following this move, I see history as linked to difference because of the latent ontology of the past. The past as history is, crossed out in this sense, present and absent. The historian is concerned with the trace, but our object of inquiry, if we can call it an object, has no ontological properties of its own in the present, and is conjured by the medium of the historian, often entangling the categories of legend and fact. And here, I want to show you this strange sign, which actually is in Sleepy Hollow. It says, the Headless Horseman Bridge, described by Washington Irving in the legend of Sleepy Hollow, formerly spanned this stream at this spot. Fiction, history, presence, absence, it's all right there put up by who? The Sleepy Hollow Historical Society. Let's let that rest. By revealing the play of difference, deconstruction unhinges the past from the as it really happened, problematizing the belief in a fixed and stable past, which is the myth of a fixed and stable present, and returns it to the realm of possibilities, past possibles and possible pasts. To be sure, the historian arrests certain of these possibilities in his or her telling of the story, but this does not negate these possibilities of the past that can return. To go a step further, deconstruction reveals the moment of decision where the story is structured according to a hierarchical ordering that privileges certain past possibles while rendering others inconceivable, unimaginable, or impossible. In this way, deconstruction reveals the legitimizing strategies of the historian while upsetting the authority of any particular telling. This can, in turn, reveal an alternative possible past based on a reevaluation of the past possibles. For history to be uncomplicated truth, simply truth, just the facts, this secret must remain hidden. But just as Scrooge was unable to extinguish the light emitting from the ghost of Christmas past, the historian cannot suppress the potential activation of the latent, and the very act of historical revision reveals the instability of historical truth, identity, and the possibility of recounting what actually happened. The latent ontology of the past is certainly bound and constrained by our imagination in the present, by that which we can imagine as having been possible. But the latent and missing portions of the past haunt us. And though we might seek to press them down like an extinguisher cap upon a flame, or outrun them, as Ichabod did the Headless Horseman, it is folly to think the past is merely what we tell it that it is. For sometimes, that which is latent, the missing portions of the past, come hurling at us like the severed head of a ghostly apparition, altering history, and in so doing, altering, or possibly altering, the future itself. Thank you very much.